Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Welcome to term two. Yeah. First of all, I just want to begin by welcoming my mother, who's here from South Africa. My mother's the one that always reminds me that I don't put into practice a lot of what I teach, so I'm still... So I'm working on it. Hope everyone had a good Pesach. Just to clarify, this term is a long term, actually, because we're starting throughout the school holidays now. We're all going to take a break in the middle for a couple of weeks, which I'll tell you, but this we're going to do two series this term. This particular series is going to be for the next 6 weeks until the 17th of May, and then we'll do another series. If I can just ask everyone to turn their mobile phones to silent. So this series is the one called Effective and Motivated Living, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. But before I do that, I wanted to just pause for a few moments, just as it happens to be, Yom HaShoah today, the day where people are remembering, of course, the 6 million martyrs who were murdered in the Holocaust. I wanted to just say two things. First of all, traditionally we know that we are taught that in the way that the Jewish tradition teaches us is that we always try and actively engage in positivity and in positive actions to do things that strengthen the memory of people that have passed on. So today, obviously, I want to dedicate the shiur to all those martyrs and all those millions of people, the 6 million who perished in the Shoah. Nice picture. Thank you, Robin. But also I want to just begin with a little story that I just saw a couple of days ago, which is not connected with the series, but I just wanted to mention it and dedicate it to Yom HaShoah. And that is, the story is told by Rabbi Shmuley Schlenger, who is the director of a Chabad house in Bakersfield, California. I'm not sure where that is, but somewhere in America. And he says that a couple of weeks ago, a young man called Michael Wesley Rell came into his Chabad house with a scroll and asked him if he knew what it was, and he thinks it's Hebrew, but perhaps he could translate it. So he says he took the scroll out. I'm going to show you a picture in a moment, and it was a small scroll wrapped in a cloth. And he says, I gently unrolled it, and to my surprise, I saw that it was a Megillah, the story of Esther, the story that we read on Purim. So he says to the guy, where did you get this? And it looked very, very aged and very old. So he said, it belonged to our grandfather, because we were cleaning out his belongings, and we found this. And we wanted to know if it has any significance, because it seems to be very old, and it looks like it's Hebrew, and thought maybe you could help. He was obviously the local rabbi in the neighborhood. So I said to him, said the rabbi, where did he find this? So he said, our grandfather was a lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force, and he brought it home after his tour in Europe during World War II. He was part of the liberation. He witnessed the hell of the Holocaust. He saw things no human being should ever see. He saved the scroll found among the smoldering ruins. I'll just show you a picture, right? This is the family. Right, that's the scroll. It's an old scroll, right? From home. So the rabbi was obviously very shaken and very moved, and he said, this is read during the holiday of Purim, which is the most festive day in the Jewish calendar. And he writes very beautifully, and he says, I started to think, where was this Megillah read? In a shtetl? In the ghetto? Perhaps in a camp? And I asked him, I said, if he would think of returning the scroll to the Jewish community. So he said, obviously, look, I have to ask my father, belonged to his father, and it's his now, so I'm going to have to ask him. Anyway, the next day, the son of the U.S. Air Force Lieutenant William David Raines came into the Chabad house, and he said to him, I'd like to return this to the Jewish community. This is where it belongs. We have to remember and never forget. And I just thought it was an amazing little story, because it just shows and it demonstrates in the most tremendous way that throughout the ages, throughout all of the generations, they've come and gone, empires and great governments and regimes and evil people who have tried and partially successfully, unfortunately, sometimes as in the Holocaust, to destroy us and weaken us. But at the end of the day, Am Yisrael Chai, at the end of the day, we're here to stay. And they've all gone, but the Megillah is still there. And the Megillah, and he says that he's hoping and he's imagining the feelings he's going to have in actually using the Megillah next Purim in his Chabad house. So I thought that was just a beautiful story to begin with in dedication of the day. Okay. So today what I want to do is just give a little bit of background and context to the topic of this particular series called Effective and Motivated Living. So the background to it is as follows. I recently came across two things, unrelated, but I'm going to relate them. The first is a new book by Rabbi Tversky, Rabbi Dr. Tversky, who you've heard me quote often before. The book is called Effective Living, An Upbeat and Unlifting Life Can Be Yours. And in the introduction, he writes that he has two of the most important things that he wants to share in this book, which he's learned in decades of his therapy, of his profession. He's a psychiatrist, as many of you would know. He's done some amazing stuff during his life. And he says the two most important things that he's learned is the following: that change is hard, number one, and number two, change is possible. Those are his two underlying themes that he wants to share, and particularly share in this book. Now, of course, many of the themes of the book belong to themes that he's written about elsewhere. He's written many books. Many of them focus on the concept of self-esteem, as we've talked about before. But this is the focus of this book, that in different areas of living, one can achieve a lifestyle of effectiveness and motivation and meaning and purpose. It is hard sometimes because we do silly things and we stand in our own way sometimes. Change is hard, but change is possible. Now, I mention that particularly because this has a lot to do with the time of the year in the Jewish calendar that we're in. Currently, we're in the period between Pesach and Shavuot, which we know is called the time of the Omer. 7 weeks. The way the Torah tells us is that after, from the second day of Pesach, we should count 49 days, 7 weeks leading up to Shavuot. So Pesach commemorates the Jewish exodus from Egypt. The Jews left Egypt and worked their way through to arrive at the destination of Mount Sinai, where they will become a nation formally and receive the Torah. And the Torah gives us the 49 days to count up to that event. And as we know, the concept of these 49 days is, as we've talked about in previous years, the 49 days are 49 days of personal growth. They're given to us specifically, out of more than any time of the year in a way, to work on our emotions, to work on the seven emotions. The reason why it's 49 is because we are taught Kabbalistically that each one of our seven emotions is intertwined with the other seven, and therefore the complete cycle of our seven emotions are seven times seven, and therefore we're given the 7 weeks to work on and to process and to refine, to upgrade, to improve our character, essentially. Now, it's interesting, of course, because we know that when we talk about the powers of the soul, and we've talked about this hundreds of times, we know that we have 10 powers of the soul, not seven. But the three, of course, are intellectual, and the seven are emotional. And the reason why we get 7 weeks is because if we need to improve ourselves, it's mainly in the seven. Because where our weaknesses lie are in our personality. And we know that our personality lives in our emotion, not in our head. The head can change easily if we want to, if we're at least committed to it. But the personality of a person lives in the emotions of the person. Why? Because at the end of the day, what is emotions, as we've talked about before? Emotion, the definition of emotions is how we respond to the outside world, which means how we respond to people, how we respond to stimulus, how we respond to things that we anticipate in the future, how we respond to things that happened yesterday in the past. It's all about how we respond in our own feeling towards everything that is happening to us and around us and other people. Right? That is emotion, as we know. The intellect is how we process things coming from the outside, but that's not our personality. That's how we absorb it. Our personality, live in our emotions, because our emotions are how we respond to the outside world. And therefore, the way the formula works is that we start with the first day of Pesach, just to give you the context, which also is connected, of course, to the three matzahs that we have on the Seder, which the Kabbalists tell us correspond to the three levels of intellect. And then from the second day, we are put on the road of working on our character to work on the seven emotions, the seven parts of our personality. Interestingly enough, by the way, just to make it clearer, the way this was done in temple times is that the counting of the Omer began with a sacrifice they would bring, a flower offering that they would bring on the second day of Pesach. And that flower offering was made of barley, which is interesting because there are many, many flower offerings in the Torah. They're all made out of wheat, with the exception of two, and one of them is the Omer. Why? The Talmud tells us, now this is not so consistent with modern day eating habits, but because today we're into all kinds of exotic and alternative grains and stuff, but in the Talmud times, wheat was considered human food, whereas barley is considered animal food, animal fodder, right? They're both grains, they both have the same blessing, but barley is considered animal food as opposed to wheat. They obviously didn't have cholent in those days, but barley is considered animal food. And the idea behind it is that, as we know, we all have a godly part to ourselves and an animal part to ourselves, and the idea of the Omer is to improve our personality, which in essence means to take the animalistic part of our personality, the animalistic part of our existence, and to work on it. Now, in order to work on our personality, however, it's not that we ignore the mind. We're working on our emotion. We're working on our responses. We're working on how we respond to the world that's around us. However, part of that process of change, and something that will come up again and again in the next few weeks, is understanding what drives our emotion, right? And part of Rabbi Twersky's work in this book, as we're going to come back to it a little bit later today and then in the coming weeks, is also understanding the tricks that our mind plays on us sometimes, which drives sometimes the irrationality of our emotions. Because one of the things we'll talk about is that often when we work on our weaknesses, we work on things that we know we do, or we work on feelings that we know we have, or responses that we know we experience, and we know that they're completely insane and irrational, and yet we still do them, right? And we need to understand why that is, and understanding why that is will help us identify the problem and help us work on it. So that's the thrust of this book, and we'll come back to it soon. But at the same time, while this was happening, I came across another very interesting article by a therapist called Chloe Madanis. I think I'm pronouncing it right. It's a beautiful article. It's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek article, and it's called The 14 Ways to be Miserable. Right. Now I'll just give you a bit of the introduction she gives in the article. It's very good. She says that most people claim they want to be happy, right? That's a normal thing. Most people, if you ask them, what do you want to be? They'll say they want to be happy, they want to lead a meaningful life, they want to enjoy themselves, they want to experience fulfillment. There's nothing like leading a fulfilling life. They want to share love and friendship with other people, and so on and so forth, right? Strangely enough, she writes, however, some people act as if they just want to be miserable, right? And they succeed remarkably at inviting misery into their lives, right? So she said, after pursuing the output of some of the finest brains in the therapy profession, I've come to the conclusion that misery is an art form. And the satisfaction people seem to find in it reflects the creative effort required to cultivate it. Right? In other words, when your living conditions are stable, peaceful and prosperous, no civil wars raging in your streets, no mass hunger, no epidemic disease, no vexation, poverty, etc., etc., making yourself miserable is a craft all on its own, requiring imagination, vision, and ingenuity. It can give life a distinctive meaning, right? So she says, so if you aspire to make yourself miserable, what are the best, most proven techniques for doing it, right? And then she talks about, she says, and why people want to do this is because people need to be aware of the benefits of being miserable, right? What's the benefit? She says, when you're miserable, people feel sorry for you. Not only that, they often feel guilty, as if your misery might somehow be their fault. So that's a good thing, right? That's part of the benefits. Then she says, when you're miserable, since you have no hopes and expect nothing good to happen, you can't be disappointed or disillusioned. Right? Then she ends off the introduction by saying, being miserable can give the impression that you're a wise and worldly person, especially if you're miserable not just about your life, but about society in general. You can project an aura of someone burdened by a form of profound, tragic, existential knowledge that happy, shallow people just can't possibly appreciate. And then she goes on and she says, what are the 14 ways, therefore, she shares with us, the 14 techniques to become miserable. Now, I'm going to just show you them very quickly, but in the coming weeks, we're going to pick on some of them because they're very good, right? So here are the first five. She says, whoops. First of all, be afraid. It's very important to be afraid all the time, particularly of economic loss. Practice sustained boredom. Cultivate the feeling that everything is predictable, that life holds no excitement. Give yourself a negative identity. That's very important. Not that just you experience negativity, but you are a negative person. Pick fights. Also a very important strategy. Number five, attribute bad intentions, right? So whenever you can, attribute the most worst possible intentions to your partner, friends, and co-workers. That's the first five. Then she continues and says, the next five is, whatever you do, do it only for personal gain. Avoid gratitude. Always be alert and in a state of anxiety. Blame your parents. That's a very important one. Blame your parents. Not in my case. I'm just talking generally. Blame your parents for your defects, shortcomings, and failures is among the most important steps you can take. And don't enjoy life's pleasures. And the last four is, number 11 is ruminate. Spend a great deal of time focused on yourself. Glorify or vilify the past. That's an interesting one. Glorify the past is telling yourself how good, happy and fortunate and worthwhile life was when you were a child or a newly married person and regretting how it's all been downhill ever since. Right? Number 13, this is a good one. Find a romantic partner to reform. Make sure that you fall in love with someone with a major defect and set out to reform him. And finally, 14, be critical. Make sure to have an endless list of dislikes and voice them often. Okay, now, I thought you'd appreciate that. Now, obviously, it's a very tongue-in-cheek article, and the point is clear. But what's interesting about it is that all of this is bizarre stuff, and yet, I think she goes on to explain that, like, you don't have to do all 14. Like, if you pick three or four, that'll also make you unhappy, right? So she says, the interesting thing is that some of these, if we all reflect honestly, and obviously we don't have to share it with the person sitting next to us, but if we all are honest with ourselves, we all engage in some of this stuff, right? And as bizarre as it sounds in an article, it's actually interesting to understand why we do some of this stuff, knowing that it's not going to make us happy, knowing that it's going to make us miserable, and yet we keep doing it. And why? So, just for today, let me just share with you the first part of Rabbi Twersky's book, where he explains quite an interesting thing. And although we've talked a lot before about the mind and the mind ruling the heart, and one of the reasons obviously that we don't change often is that things we understand in our mind don't make it through to the heart. We've talked about that. We talked about head and heart and liver, that concept of Mitzrayim, the narrowness of the throat, how sometimes intellectual ideas get stuck when they need to transition from the world of intellect to the world of emotion, and so on and so forth. But it gives us a bit of an added insight into the whole thing of how this actually works, and it's very interesting, and I'm going to share it with you. He starts off the first chapter of the book by explaining that the psychological study of the human mind indicates that the mind has three layers. Okay. The conscious, this is what he calls it, the conscious, the pre-conscious, and the subconscious. Right. Now, let's just explain what that means. Conscious means the things I am doing or focused on right now. Right? In other words, the conscious is paper thin. It's only what I'm doing, what I'm completely conscious out of right now. So right now, you're sitting, you're listening to a shiur, you're looking at the screen, or whatever the case is, that's the conscious, right? Pre-conscious means things that come just before or after the conscious. In other words, it's still in my consciousness, and I can slip into it very, very easily, like what I had this morning, or an argument that I had this morning, or a good thing that happened to me this morning before I came here, which might explain why I'm in a good mood, and so on. And that. It's stuff that is happening now in my life, just not now. Right? Is that clear? So it's pre-conscious. In other words, the stuff that is just before the conscious, but it lives still in the world of consciousness. You can't say it's in the subconscious. It's not. It's in the conscious. It happened last night. It happened this morning. It's the conversation I just had. It's not conscious right now because I'm not thinking about it right now because I'm concentrating on what I'm doing, but it's pre-conscious. Right? And then there's the subconscious. The subconscious, sometimes referred to as the unconscious, which is like, he explains it, like a computer hard drive. Right? Now, what he says, which is an amazing thing, by the way, and in itself, it's a whole discussion of how things can affect us. The subconscious of a person is like the hard drive of a computer, right? If you ever rebooted your computer or had someone look at your computer, you'll know that the hard drive stores stuff that you wouldn't ever be aware of. I had this experience a number of weeks ago where my computer said, "I'm out of memory," and I'm not out of memory because I don't have a lot of photos on my desktop and or in my computer, and I'm not using a lot of programs. I just use very basic programs, and it keeps on telling me that it's in memory. But unbeknown to me, stuff that I maybe downloaded 5 years ago or whatever the case is, it's stuck there. It gets stuck on the hard drive. You never see it. You never notice it. It's there, and it just clogs up the memory of the computer, right? So human beings are very similar. The difference is that we have a huge hard drive, and number two, it's very difficult to erase. A regular hard drive of a computer, you can actually delete stuff. Our hard drive, it's very difficult to delete stuff, right? And actually what happens is experiences that we go through in life get stored in the subconscious on our hard drive of our mind almost forever. Very, very difficult to erase. And it has its own set of rules, and it affects us in the most bizarre ways. He tells an interesting story just to demonstrate this, right? He said he believes, now Rabbi Twersky, one of the things he does do in his therapy is he performs hypnosis. And he says that he felt that a certain patient could benefit from hypnosis. So in the first session, afterwards the guy turned around and said to him, "I guess I'm not a good candidate for hypnosis because I wasn't really hypnotized." So he told him that in fact you were hypnotized. And he was very skeptical. He says, "No, I don't believe it." So he said to him, "Could you tell me the names of some of your classmates in second grade?" He said, "Second grade? That was like over 40 years ago." Like, "No, I wouldn't have a clue. Different country to play." So he says, try remember the names of the people in second grade. He says, "Impossible." So fine. Then he put him back into a hypnotic trance, hypnotized him, and then brought him out of it. And then he told him the names of his second class classmates. And he said, "Wow, I haven't thought about those people in 40 years." Right? Where were they? So those names were not in his conscious, not even in his preconscious on any level, but they were in his subconscious. Right? Now, the problem with the subconscious is the subconscious, as I said, has rules of its own. Right? And just like emotions, and this is an important thing to understand, just like emotions are not rational, we often experience emotional responses that we know, and sometimes we know even while we're doing them that it's not rational or logical. The subconscious works the same way. Subconscious sometimes sends signals and affects the way we respond to the outside world in ways which are completely bizarre and completely illogical. Okay? For example, he says, he takes an example. This is one of the ways it can happen. He says he walked into a doctor's office and took an immediate dislike to the receptionist. He never met her. Right? Now, because he is who he is, and sometimes it happens to us, we just don't like certain people, right? And it bothered him. So it bothered him, like, "I don't know this person didn't do anything to me, never affected me negatively, doing her job, she's quite polite, quite efficient, and I've got this dislike, and I can't understand why." And upon reflection, he realized that something about her had reminded him of his fifth grade teacher, who was a really, really bad teacher. And there was an association, a completely illogical and irrational association. The two people have nothing to do with each other. Completely different countries, continents, different times of his life. It makes no difference. In the world of the irrational, the world of the subconscious, there is no time. It's like a dream world almost. It's like the world of imagination. Things that happened 50 years ago, like they happen now, tomorrow, it's all the same. Things fit together, parts can become like a whole can become parts. There are connections that are made that are completely stupid, and yet they happen all the time. Right? Now, the subconscious can be an amazing tool, right? Because sometimes, if we've had pleasant experiences, then they affect us positively. By the way, something also that I think I once shared this with you, and this is just shows you how important this is. Sometimes it's so important, I'm just digressing for a moment, but just to share this with you. Sometimes it's so important to deal with things on the conscious level before they go into the subconscious, right? I shared this with you once when I talked to you about the prayer that people make, say, before they go to sleep, the prayer of forgiveness, right? Because when you have a run-in with someone or someone you know you have resentment and so on and so forth, so there's a concept of before one going to sleep to have this prayer that's printed in the many siddurim about really forgiving the person, right? And one of the ideas is, even the person might not even know about it, but it's important for me. It's important for me to let go. Why is it so important? One of the reasons is, it's so important before I go to sleep, is because when you go to sleep, that's part of what happens. Stuff from the conscious goes to the subconscious and gets stored there. And when it's there forever. And it could surface at any time and spark an experience, spark a feeling, spark some sort of response. That response can be to that person, the response can be to someone else, and it just can be a negative feeling within myself. And that's why sometimes when I deal with something in the conscious, not that the story won't go to anything, everything will be stored in the subconscious, but if I deal with it in the world of the conscious and I channel it so it becomes a positive experience rather than a negative experience, right? Then as it seeps down into the hard drive, it seeps down in a much more positive way than a negative way. And then hopefully has a much better and more positive effect on the way I deal with things later at any given time. So that's just an interesting, a very, very fascinating idea. Right? Now, another example of how the stuff could just like spark things is sometimes something can just ignite a feeling of anger. I'm sure we all have this, right? Someone can say something or do something that provokes an incredible feeling of anger that is completely irrational, right? And part of that might have to do with stuff that's accumulated feelings of anger. Sometimes people have feelings of anger that they've never dealt with. Again, the same idea. If we don't deal with things, they go deeper into our subconscious undealt with. And what happens when they're undealt with, they come out and they do crazy things, right? And they just ignite negativity, ignite responses, ignite anger when we don't even know why. And it's got to do with stuff that's happened in the past, right? Because what's what he calls an anger file. Sometimes we have an anger file that we have stored back somewhere in our subconscious, and anything could trigger that anger file to open up and just come pouring out. Which again, and can happen within a family, it can happen within friends, it can happen within a society. And that goes back to that article sometimes where we choose to do things that are crazy. We choose to hang on to things, to blame people, to ruminate, to not have gratitude, whatever the case is. And we know that it's wrong, we know that it's irrational, but it might have to do with how we are being programmed and how we're being affected by our subconscious. Now, the subconscious mind, one of its roles, he explains, just an interesting concept this, one of its roles is also to protect the person. The problem is, and this goes back to an idea that I've shared with you before, the problem is that the subconscious mind often does things in self-interest, which is connected to the ego of the person. Because the ego of a person also lives in the subconscious, right? And that's a very, very important thing to understand. Because when we talked about the Omer before, and we talked about the seven emotions are symptoms of what's happening behind the seven emotions. So seven emotions are driven by rationalization of the mind, but what happens is that what's behind the rationalization of the mind is the subconscious, which often drives part of what's happening on the conscious. And what's in the subconscious is our ego. And when the subconscious protects us, it sometimes protects us wrongly and mistakenly because it protects us in self-interest. I'll give you a very stupid and simple example. I'm sure you've had this experience, if not now, at least when you were, a school-aged child or whatever. You know how sometimes your alarm clock rings because you have an appointment, let's say, the dentist, right? Or you have to do something you really don't want to do. And I'm sure you've had this experience where instead of hearing your alarm clock, you start to dream a story of alarm clock, right? How does that actually happen? Apparently, the way it happens is, right, it's a favor that your subconscious mind is doing for you. It's a wrong favor. It's a bad favor. But it's a subconscious mind do, because in your subconscious there's something you know you have to do in the conscious, but you don't want to do it. You don't like the dentist, or you don't want to face up to a certain person, or you don't want to have a conversation with someone, or whatever the case is. And what happens is the subconscious mind triggers a new reality. Now, the subconscious mind could do that because subconscious mind is irrational. It's higher than the rationale. So what it does is it concocts a story, and it concocts a reality. So the alarm clock is ringing and you're hearing it, but instead you're living in a completely different reality. What's happening is you're actually living in a reality where there's a story and someone went to sleep and they heard an alarm clock or whatever the case is, right? So that's an interesting thing to understand. I mean, that's a stupid example, but the truth is it happens all the time in life where we create certain realities for ourselves because our subconscious is helping us do that in our own self, sometimes egocentric interest, right? Which, by the way, goes back to what we said before. Sometimes when we trigger things or when we create a dislike to someone. Now, if you suddenly have a dislike to someone, for example, which is triggered maybe by an association of being connected to someone you didn't like many, many years ago, right? Most people, if they're not aware of that and they continue to dislike the person, they will eventually come up with a story of why they don't like them, right? Very interesting thing. Post-rationalization. Why do we do that? Because we don't like to remain stupid people. We don't like to remain irrational people, right? It's by the way, going back to what the Talmud says, it's what the Talmud calls sinat chinam. We know that the second temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred. And what does baseless hatred mean, right? That's what we taught. We taught that the second temple was destroyed because of sinat chinam, baseless hatred. Now, some people will tell you there's no such thing as baseless hatred. What do you mean baseless hatred? I don't have baseless hatred. I hate 4 million people, but there's a good reason for it. And each person I can explain to you why the reason is, why I dislike them. So how can no one will ever admit that they hate someone else without any basis, correct? Most people will never admit to that. Yeah.
Can you really hate someone for no reason?
Oh, yes. And the reason is this. Because it's not about hating the person. It's about developing a hate or a reason to hate or resist them or to reject them based on ego alone. And that ego can be associated with a subconscious mind that is protecting us, but protecting us in an egocentric way. Right? So it could be as simple as that the person reminds me of someone I don't like or someone that hurt me in the past. Right? I'm not aware of how the mind works, and that's why it's important to be aware. Now, we know that if you've just met someone and you find a dislike to them, that's our problem. We need to work on that. But a lot of people don't work on that because they have this intense dislike to that person, or that person has stood in their way or threatened them or whatever the case is. They don't know how to deal with it, so therefore they create a reason why they hate them. And once you create a reason why you hate someone, that reason grows. It just extrapolates. And then it becomes a conflict. It becomes tension. It becomes a rational thing, right? With the person never being able to admit that it's in fact irrational. You understand what I'm saying? So, but this is why Rabbi Twersky dedicates a chapter to actually explaining to us how the mind works, because we need to understand sometimes the tricks and the selfish tricks and the egocentric tricks that actually the mind plays on us, so that we can be aware of it. We don't need to go to psychotherapy and exactly understand why it's like the person, but we do have to understand that maybe it's because of something that's in the subconscious, and we have to deal with it with strategies that he goes through, which we'll go through over the next few weeks. Yep.
Can I share something that will take a couple of minutes that's exactly about this? There's a technique in chiropractic called neuro-emotional technique. It uses kinesiology to nut out exactly what you're talking about. And I had an experience recently where the thing, and it's all emotions, not just anger, it can be any emotion. So the first thing is to establish the emotion, which through muscle testing. So I had an experience that was about irrationality to do with someone now, and then by use of muscle testing, he said to me, something happened when you were 11 that had that same sense of irrationality. So the first thing that popped into my mind was my bat mitzvah. I have no idea why. So as he asked my body and asked questions, it was all about the fact that we were all asked to wear white for our bat mitzvah, and one girl came for the first fitting in a completely multicoloured floral dress. And at the time, it was my sense of, but that's not right. That's and that's what it, and that happens all the time. It's the most
interesting, fascinating
technique, but that's exactly what it's all about, tapping into the subconscious, where if it's not dealt with at the time, it can raise its head in a way that seems complete. I haven't had that thought.
Yeah, it's great. It's an amazing thing. Absolutely. Now, the other thing that subconscious minds does to us, as a favor but a bad favor, often, is the concept of denial, right? Which stands in the way of us ever improving. As we know, the first step to change is to know we need to change. But change is uncomfortable. Going back to the first paragraph in the book, change is hard, but change is possible. But change is hard, because change is confronting. Change means I have to confront my weaknesses, I have to actually be aware of them, I have to know how my personality is working, I have to be mindful of what I'm doing and how I'm responding, how I'm hurting myself, how I'm hurting other people, and so on and so forth, right? So denial is an amazing thing. And some people are in complete denial, often, of things. In extreme cases, it's very obvious that people say, oh, that person's in total denial, right? It could be with an emotion, it could be with grief, it could be with lots of things. But it can also be with a personality flaw. And that denial comes also from the irrational ego that rests in the subconscious, where the subconscious has the ability to create new realities. And those realities are very real. And once that reality is created, it can be very well explained by the rational mind. Because the rational mind is very affected by the irrational mind. The rational conscious mind is very affected by the subconscious. There's a very beautiful passage in Tanakh, in the book of Isaiah, where he urges people to repent and urges people to improve their ways. And he says the following. He says, this people is flattening its heart, hardening its ears, and sealing its eyes. What does he mean, sealing with its eyes? He says, lest it see with its eyes, hear with its ears, and understand with its heart, so that it will repent and be healed. In other words, in order to repent and be healed, in order to improve, you have to hear with your ears, you have to see with your eyes. But they've not done that. They've hardened their ears and they've closed their eyes. In other words, they've gone into complete denial. And when someone's in denial, they will explain to you in the most convincing and persuasive way how their reality is correct. And it's a reality they've created for themselves, or it's a reality their subconscious has created for them that allows them to just completely ignore who they are, completely ignore the true reality and go into a completely different reality and live that lie. People live lies often. Where does that lie come from? It's an irrational reality that is created by the subconscious.
Where does, I think it's called cognitive dissonance, when you know the right thing that you don't answer, where does that fit into the consciousness?
Okay, so that's different. See, cognitive dissonance is you're already a step ahead. Cognitive dissonance means I'm not in denial, right? So I am working on it. I know that I have to eat better. I know that I have to be healthy. I know that I have to talk nicely to my sister, my brother, whatever the case is. And I'm just not getting there. And that's because I brought it into my conscious mind, just my conscious mind hasn't yet made the trip down to the emotion, right? The problem is that sometimes we start behind that. We're not even there. We're not even in the conscious mind yet, right? Because our conscious mind is creating and rationalizing a whole new reality, which is being driven by an erroneous trick of the subconscious mind, which is a fascinating insight. Yeah. True. Yeah, it's a controversial. Yeah. I mean, what we'll come to obviously is, and we've shared this many times, that there's something before the subconscious, right, which allows us not to be tricked by the subconscious. But we'll get to that, as we know, right? The purity of the soul, the core essence of who we are, can stand above all of that, and therefore will not be bound by the subconscious either, right? But for now, we're talking about what happens in the subconscious, and it does. It creates an incredible reality. So when you talk about cognitive dissonance, that's, if you're holding with that problem, that's a good thing. That's a good sign. At least you've moved away from the subconscious into the conscious and you're thinking properly. You just now need to know how to bring the rational mind into the emotion. That's a journey in its own right. Another interesting concept of the subconscious is a thing they call displacement, where you had one experience, but you let it out, or you become anxious, or you experience anxiety in another thing, right? Like, for example, and also without logic. So, for example, let's say someone had a bad experience with a dog. A child, let's say, was bitten by a big dog. when they, maybe that's my problem, the, right, a big dog when they were 4 years old, right? It could be that 10 years later, a small puppy who your person knows will not hurt them will create the same level of anxiety, because it's displaced anxiety. I mean, if they would see the same animal again, we understand. That animal hurt me, so I'm anxious they're going to hurt me again. But there's a totally, but in the subconscious minds, they don't make those size comparisons. It's a dog hurt me, so a dog hurt me. The same thing, right? And that and that kind of thing. So that's just a little bit of how the subconscious mind works. And it's an important discussion to have, because what we're going to do in the coming weeks is, once we understand that that happens, right, the awareness of this concept is so critical. As we've talked about many times, the saying that's often spoken about called Yediata Makah Chatzi Refuah, knowing, diagnosing the disease is half the cure, right? Because sometimes when we're aware, and therefore because we're aware, we're okay to question ourselves, which, by the way, also needs to be done carefully, because sometimes we over-question ourselves, and that's not a good idea. But we do need to question ourselves sometimes, where's this coming from? What's driving it? Is it my ego? Is it some past experience? Is it the subconscious playing tricks on me? Right? It's okay to question ourselves. Once we do that, then we can start to say, well, maybe it is irrational. Maybe it is not right. Maybe it's a silly strategy. Maybe it's not a good reality I'm creating for myself. And therefore, I have to start the process of creating the effective reality and creating a lifestyle and a routine which is meaningful and is more fulfilling and is motivating and is effective. But I can only do that if I have that first step. And the first step is to be, is this awareness, right? And, you know, it's interesting, I often think about this with children and parenting. I think there's a few, and maybe I think this is sometimes missed today, there's a few, because often we treat symptoms when children grow up and it's too late, because the symptoms are symptoms of something and we never treat the cause, right? The perhaps one of the biggest gifts we can give children, and all of us for that matter, but starting young, and maybe schools need to think about this, of how they bring this into to the education system and so on and so forth, is training a child from when they grow in a couple of critical foundations, right? One of them is self-control. We've talked about this before. But the other is the need to change, the need to go beyond yourself, the need not to be comfortable in your own reality. Because when we have that foundation, which is really the theme of the Omer, and the theme of Pesach, about not being comfortable who we are, going out of our own Egypt, then we at least get to the stage that I'm okay to question where I am and who I am now. Because if we took complacency, blocks any route to growth. And complacency often comes from that denial, from that reality that our subconscious mind creates for us, that everything is wonderful. And it's okay the way it is. And if I know it's not wonderful, and if I know it doesn't make sense, I'll make it make sense. Why am I going to make it make sense? Because that's who I am, and that's what I'm comfortable doing, and that's the reality I've created for myself. If we can just get past that, you sometimes find that, if you want to understand this, you look at a narcissist, for example, right? Which is an extreme version of what I'm talking about. But I'm not talking about narcissism now, because we all experience this. It's not about being a narcissist. But if you look at a narcissist, it's exactly that. The narcissist will explain to you everything and will rationalize every bit of behavior. And it's a person you can see who's just a completely trapped individual. Cannot move forward because they're trapped in this reality. It's almost impossible, because you can never change unless you want to. You can never change unless you're aware of that reality you've created for yourself. You can never change unless you know that there's what to change, and that maybe the story you're telling yourself and the reality you're giving yourself is not the effective one, right? Once a person makes that commitment to change, then they can get help. People can help them, books can help them, everything can help them. But not until they've broken out of that shell. And that's the shell that is often created by the subconscious mind, and that's why it's such an important foundation. So what we'll do is we will start looking at these various agents of change, the various strategies of change, and how we deal with this, with managing the subconscious mind in order to better manage our emotions and our responses to the outside world. But before we do that, I want to just end with sharing one idea, which I have shared before, but it's a very, very important idea. And it's also another very critical foundation to the process of change and the process of living a more effective life, or achieving happiness, or getting rid of some of those bizarre tools that Chloe Medanis explains in a beautiful article. And that also is from the whole process of counting the Omer. So just to go back to this mitzvah of counting the Omer. So the idea is we count 49 days. It's an interesting mitzvah. It's done every evening. We say today is the first day of the Omer, the second day of the Omer, and so on and so forth. And in Jewish law, there's a very interesting discussion, a halachic discussion actually, which has halachic ramifications, which I'm not going to go into now, but just I want to share it with you so you understand the concept. There's a very interesting halachic discussion about this mitzvah of counting the Omer. It's one of the 630 mitzvot. But it's a very interesting halachic discussion about this mitzvah. Is it one mitzvah or is it 49 mitzvot, right? In other words, is it one, do I fulfill this mitzvah if I've counted all 49 days? Or is each day a separate mitzvah, right? And it's got various different halachic ramifications. For example, you make a blessing every night on counting the Omer, and if I forget one night, does that mean I've undermined the whole thing? Can I still count the next night? And so on and so forth, with a lot of halachic literature written on this mitzvah to analyze this process and to understand the various opinions and the rationale behind the various opinions and so on. But on a philosophical level, what I wanted to share with you is this idea that they're actually both right. In other words, like this. When we grow and when we journey, so on one hand, there's an overall goal, right? Like we talked about when we talked about the seven habits. Stephen Covey says, begin with the end in mind, right? In Jewish thought, as we mentioned many, many, many times, especially when we talk about the idea of mindfulness and being focused on the moment, we live in the moment, but not for the moment. You've heard me say this many times, right? We don't live for the moment. Living for the moment is a very anti-Jewish concept. In other words, we live for a goal. We have a goal, begin with the end in mind. We do have a mission statement, and we want to get there. And we have an ideal, we have certain levels of improvement and spirituality and meaningfulness and fulfillment that we want to reach, right? So we do. So on that level, that's the concept of the Omer being one mitzvah. Just like when the Jews left Egypt, they left Egypt and there was a goal. The goal was to reach Mount Sinai. And with that goal in mind, that's what motivated them every step of the way. I spoke about, I think, last term when they came to the Red Sea and it didn't split and there was this difference of opinion about what to do, and God said, you've forgotten the goal. There's a goal. The goal is to move towards Mount Sinai. Keep moving. And there was that individual called Nachshon ben Aminadav who jumped into the water and the water split, right? So there is a goal. In other words, we have an ultimate goal. We have a communal goal. We have a universal goal, which is working towards the ultimate state of redemption through Mashiach. And each person in their own life should have big goals, ultimate goals. And on that level, that's the concept behind the Omer being one mitzvah. But at the same time, we are taught that every day is a specific mitzvah. Because when we grow, and this is true with everything we talk about, but it's going to be very true with the strategies that we're going to discuss. And that is that when we move forward, we always need to remember that we do it one day at a time. And that each day is its own accomplishment. Each day is its own achievement. Every day is a separate mitzvah. And even if you mess up one day, there's an opportunity to improve and to rectify that the next day. And that's perhaps the rationale behind the opinion of every day of the Omer being a separate mitzvah. The Omer is like climbing a ladder. Each rung is something special. Each rung needs to be celebrated. Each rung needs to be understood and appreciated because each day is separate. There's a beautiful story, just going back to the way we started. There's a story. Talks about also, it's a story of resilience and how you get through tough times and so on and so forth. So there was a woman, I just read this recently, a woman called Miriam Peretz. She lost a son in one of the Israeli wars, and she had went through a lot of tragedy. And then a different child she lost, it was a very, very tragic life. And she now lectures and she uses her struggles to inspire other people and so on and so forth. And one of the questions she gets asked often is, how do you do it? Like, how do you get through all of this, right? So she said the following. She tells a story that one time, after one of her sons passed away, her grandson asked his grandmother to make meatballs. Right? So she said to him, how can I make meatballs? She thought to herself, actually. She said, my son's favorite food was meatballs, and my heart is broken, and how can I even consider making it? Right? But a few weeks later, she says, she went to the house for Shabbos, and her grandson said to her again, please, Safta, I love your meatballs. Will you please make the meatballs? Obviously being unaware of the association that it would mean for her. Right? So she writes with a heavy heart. She got the ingredients. And what usually takes her 20 minutes took her 3 hours. When she was done, she had a pot of meatballs, a pot of sauce, and a pot of tears. That's what she says, right? But then she says, as she made the meatballs, her tefillah was this. She said, I offered up a prayer to God. She says, not to be happy tomorrow, not for next week, not the next month, not even next year, but I daven for the strength and the happiness to make this one meatball. Meatball by meatball, minute by minute. Please remember that it's not an overnight process. It's not day by day, it's not hour by hour. It's minute by minute, meatball by meatball. Right? That's what she writes. Very, very beautiful. So the same thing is true when it comes to growth, and the same thing is a lesson from the Omer. Every day is another day. And we have to be very, because one of the other blockages to growth is that we go back to this thing that change is hard. We forget the second part, change is possible. But part of the change being hard is that it's too overwhelming, right? If I have a weakness, I just can't become perfect overnight. I just can't master this thing overnight. It's not going to be possible. The answer is you don't have to master overnight. Every step of change is beautiful. And that's the Omer. Every day is another mitzvah. Every day is a step closer, and every day we have to appreciate and celebrate. So bear that in mind as we go through the Omer and we go through the series, where we talk about the various strategies, dealing with the tricks of the subconscious mind, dealing with the various things that stand in the way of happiness, and we learn how to deal with them. The way we deal with them is not to perfect it. As a great educator once said, don't reward perfection, reward direction. In other words, we have to just go in the right direction, step by step, day by day, minute by minute, and slowly but slowly improve one step at a time. Have a great week.